The power of having a world of information at our fingertips can be dizzying. With the help of search engines like Google, research that would have taken hours can be accomplished in minutes. But what's the price? Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is wondering, is Google making us stupid? That's the title of his recent article that ran in the July-August issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Nicholas Carr is one of our guests this hour. He's the author of the book, The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. We're also joined this hour by Marianne Wolfe, director of the Center for Reading and Language at Tufts University. An open door for you today as well. I hope you'll call up with your take on the question, is Google making us stupid? Have you noticed it's hard for you to focus on longer books or articles that require deep reading and concentration? Or is the efficiency of the internet going to usher in maybe a new era of democratic knowledge? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Nicholas Carr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
And Marianne Wolfe, welcome to you as well.
Of course. Thank you.
And Nicholas Carr, tell me, when did you first notice that things were different when you sat down to maybe read a long book?
I think I've been vaguely aware of it for a few years now, but I noticed that it seemed to be getting worse rather than better. And really, within the last year, I began to make the connection between what I was, the struggles I had in immersing myself in a book or any other kind of act of deep thinking, in my increasing use of the internet. Because what I noticed was that the mental feeling I had when I would sit down and try to concentrate was the same feeling that I had when I was on the net, looking for distraction, wanting to click from link to link, and getting antsy when I had to concentrate for a long period of time.
What about you, Marianne Wolfe? Have you seen an upsurge in what Nicholas is talking about?
Well, indeed, the book that I just finished writing began 8 years ago. And when I began it, I had a completely different approach to what I was reading. And over the time, and all this was about reading. And by the end, I found myself almost a victim of the same thing that I was worried about in others. I was seeking information quickly, efficiently, and really not even giving myself the time to reflect about what I was hoping to write about. So it was a sort of a world inside of a world, looking at myself inside the process that I was trying to describe.
And Nicholas, you start your article with some anecdotes about people who report the same things. What are people saying?
Well, you know, when I began to notice this in myself and began to make, at least a hypothetical connection with internet use, at about the same time, which is over the course of the past year, I started seeing quite a few other people describing very similar symptoms, often bloggers or other people online. And I began asking, acquaintances and friends, and not all of them, but a significant number, said, gee, that sounds exactly like what's happening to me. And so what they're saying is that they're just having trouble maintaining their concentration, particularly when they sit down with a book or a long article. Their mind starts to drift. They want to rush off and check their email. It's just becoming more and more difficult for them to sustain kind of a long train of thought. And for some of them, it's they simply have given up on what we might call, what Marianne Wolfe refers to as deep reading, reading long things. They just skim everything now.
Is there shown to be a correspondence between what you're talking about and the sales of books, of novels, that kind of thing?
I'm not really sure. I mean, we know that for a long time now, the readership of what we call serious literature has been declining, and for many reasons, and I think the net is one of them, but television and other things. But I don't know, I haven't looked at whether there's a particular connection between between sales of types of books and mm-hmm. internet use.
What is it about the way that we surf the net? Is it that we just can click from one screen to another, follow links, that it's sort of turning us into a nation of people who just really can't concentrate? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, the hypothesis, the thesis is that we know, for one thing, we know that the human brain is malleable, that it can adapt and adapt fairly quickly to new stimuli, to new media, and actually at, you know, at a very deep biological level in the actual circuitry of the brain. And we can hypothesize that as the internet becomes more and more our kind of universal medium for gathering information and for entertainment, that it begins to influence the actual structure of our minds. And we begin to adapt to, you know, the ability to leap from piece of information to piece of information through hyperlinking and not in kind of constantly leave what we had been starting to concentrate on in order to read something else. And also along with that is that as more and more media, whether it's television or radio or books or anything, turn into internet media, make the move online, we're surrounded when we're online by all sorts of distractions, by everything else that's going on our computer, by email popping up, instant messages coming in, feed readers telling us some new headline has emerged. So we're relearning, I think, how to read in a very different way, not mm-hmm. through sustained concentration, but by jumping around and by being kind of constantly distracted.
What do you think, Marianne? Are you seeing that in the way the brain is changing?
That I think that's the perfect segue into what cognitive neurosciences are telling us about what the reading brain is and how it's learned. And I'd like to say just two points. The first is to give some supportive data to what Nick just said. When you think about what the brain does when it reads, it's actually having to form a whole new circuit. We were never genetically programmed to read. Reading is an invention of human beings. But it's also reflecting one of the greatest aspects of the human brain, which is our ability to take old structures like vision and language and rearrange them and make a whole new circuit for something new as a function. Now, that's an extraordinary capacity we have, but the downside, the other side of that is that there is no one circuit for reading. We can look at different languages and see that there's a Chinese circuit for reading, there's a Hebrew circuit, there's an English alphabet circuit. And that also means that when children learn to read, they're different from the adult brain. They are learning to form and fashion through our explicit teaching, by and large, how to form this comprehending reading brain. That also means that they don't have any one model that genetically they are going to reach. They are going to reach different kinds of circuits. And my real worry about all of this is not a binary worry, but a developmental worry. It's, in other words, it's not are we going to be literate readers, are we going to be digital readers, but how do we form a reading brain that has in its formation all of the stops we have on our present circuit, and those precious milliseconds that our reading brain, yours, Veronica, mine, Nick's, our listeners, all of us have this circuit that is set to comprehend, to infer, to have insight, to be critical and analytical, because that's how we were formed. That was the process of our formation. Well, children who are really exposed over and over, are they going to develop a circuit that actually short circuits those deeper processes of inference and critical analysis? And will they be so inured to immediate access that they'll have neither the motivation nor literally the time, because of the medium itself, to go below the surface, to go below the text? They seem to have everything on the surface for themselves.
Why would we lose the ability to be critical thinkers and deep thinkers because we read differently? Can you lay that out a little bit?
Well, if you think about what reading does, let's just take an analogy of a tour bus in a city. That tour bus can make all the stops and you have one version of that city. But what if it doesn't make the last stops of the tour? You're going to lose a lot of what you might have known about that city. The reading circuit is somewhat like that, and the last stops are the deepest part of the process. You get so automatic in the first parts of the circuit that you have the capacity to go beyond and connect all the previous knowledge you have yourself with what you are reading, and then go beyond it. When you have a medium that's emphasizing, and this is a concern, not knowledge, Veronica, this is really important, where our evidence stops is right here. We do not have the best evidence yet. We have to, in fact, one of my whole hopes in this discourse is to push for really good research that we can literally image children and adults as they are reading and see whether our concerns, Nick's personal observations, his friend's personal observations, is actually verified by our data of what the brain is doing. Certainly, we have all kinds of anecdotal evidence to that end, including the NEA's, the National Endowment for Arts, recent report to read or not to read, when they're really looking at the decline of comprehension skills in our high schoolers, and of course the lack of reading books by these same kids.
And Nick Carr, you talk about in your article, you have an anecdote about Nietzsche and how he was changed when he started using a typewriter. Can you tell us about that and what you think it illustrates?
Sure. Nietzsche, the philosopher, had severe eye trouble as an adult, as he got older, and he found it increasingly physically difficult to write. It created headaches for him to focus on a page. And fortunately for him, the typewriter was invented, and he bought one, and he was able to learn to touch type, so he could keep his eyes closed, and he could go back to writing. But a friend, there's some interesting correspondence between him and a friend, and the friend points out that his style of writing and even his style of thinking seemed to change when he used this new technology in place of the paper and pen. And Nietzsche wrote back that yes, he noticed that too, and said that our tools, the tools we use to write or to read, also influence our thoughts. And I think I use that in the essay to get across the point, and it's a point made by many people, made famous by Marshall McLuhan in the 60s, that the media we use, the technologies and tools we use to gather information, to read, to otherwise process knowledge and to use our intellect, influence the way we think, the way, cognitive patterns, memory, and even our conception of ourselves, I think, and of our place in the world. And that's one of the one of the main themes of my article, that what the internet seems to be doing to us in influencing our way of thinking is nothing new. It happens, I believe, over and over again through human history, and you could even argue that the ability to read deeply, at least at a broad level of society, really only emerged 500 years ago with the invention of another technology, the printing press. So these changes, I think, are nothing new. And even though, as Marianne pointed out, we don't yet have hard scientific proof that this is going on today, we have a lot of evidence that it's gone on in the past, and I think we should be concerned, if not worried, that it's going on again.
Well, here's something that's fascinating to me. I mean, how long has the internet been around, really? Do you know?
Well, the internet's been around for a couple of decades, but for most people, the World Wide Web was invented in 1990, so it was really the mid-90s when most people started to go
online. These changes have occurred that quickly? Is the brain that plastic that within, a couple decades of using this new kind of reading, this new kind of gathering information, that we really would have changed that much?
I think what I found in my research is that, yes, it is possible. The brain is very adaptable. And that doesn't mean necessarily that it's changed permanently. If we changed our behavior, we could assume that we could relearn some of the things we seem to be unlearning. But sure, it's a matter, if you, and this is going to be speaking metaphorically, but if you stop using a particular muscle, that muscle starts withering fairly quickly. If you stop using certain mental capacities, I think you begin to see an erosion in those as well. And it's important to say that this, you know, this is a biological change. It's certainly not a genetic change.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break right now, and then we'll be back to talk more about this. We're talking with Nicholas Carr, the author of The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. And more specifically, his recent article is Google Making Us Stupid, which appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. Also, we're joined this hour by Marianne Wolfe, who is director of the Center for Reading and Language at Tufts University, and the author of Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain. Hoping you'll be joining us this hour as well. And tell us if you notice what our guests this hour are talking about. Do you find that with the advent of a lifestyle which includes lots of surfing the net, that it is hard to focus on longer books? Do you find yourself more likely to skim or to get distracted? And do you think something is being lost by all the time we spend online? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of great stuff still to come today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 1 o'clock, stay tuned for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. After 1, the latest solar energy news, including a look at the legislative snarl that has solar industry execs biting their nails, and what you can do to bring solar power to your house without breaking the bank. That's 1 o'clock's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Veronica Rickert back with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about whether or not the internet is eroding our ability to concentrate, to read deeply, to think deeply. Talking with Nick Carr, the author of the article is Google Making Us Stupid, which appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. Also joined by Marianne Wolfe, who is director of the Center for Reading and Language at Tufts University. And let's go to the phones now. We've got a call coming in from Rick in Highbridge. Hello, Rick. You're on the air.
Hello. I guess I would like to... I'm 59 years old, and I'm very interested in language and how we accumulate it, but I have heard this sort of argument many times in my life, and just as a recent... I have a 30-year-old daughter who watched Sesame Street, and that was supposed to be the thing that was going to wipe out her ability to think. And I'd say that she still reads and thinks and has twins, and the reason she doesn't read big books is because of the economic situation in this country. Everybody's got to work. So I'm kind of wondering, your guess, and I don't mean to disparage their learnedness, but, you know, are there other things besides this? I think these are easy. Google's easy to blame. I love Google. My life is way richer than it was 20 years ago. So I'm curious what they'd say, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for that phone call. And Nick Carr, what do you think? You talk about the anxiety that comes along with new technology. What do you think about what Rick is saying? Maybe we're getting too worked up about it.
Well, I think Rick's absolutely right to point out that we have to be careful about drawing conclusions about cause and effect. Certainly there are lots of things that can influence people's ability to concentrate. Kind of as a counter to that, you know, I've, in my own experience and in the experience of others, it seems very, very, like a very suspicious connection between what I'm experiencing, what others are experiencing, and the patterns of thinking and information retrieval that we exhibit when we're online. Because as I said earlier, it's not just a matter of finding it hard to concentrate or focus. When I actually sit down and do that, try to read or try to follow a line of thought, my mind begins to act in exactly the same way it acts when it's online. It begins to crave, you know, where are the links? Why, can I jump ahead here? Can I go there? Maybe I should check my email. You know, there seems to be a very close resemblance between what's my problem in reading and what I experience, what I've trained my brain to do when I'm online. So I think, I think we should certainly be wary, and we should realize that, it's easy to blame new technologies often, and, you know, everybody from Socrates on has raised concerns about that. But nevertheless, I think, you know, the difference between, say, Sesame Street or even television in the internet is that the internet is really turning in to our universal medium, that it's kind of the default way now that we go where we go and get information. And we've never really seen anything like it. in history up until now. So we can, you could certainly, I think, assume that if it was going to have cognitive effects, it would have particularly strong ones.
And what do you think, Marianne?
Well, I have two thoughts. One very quick one to tell Rick about his Sesame Street. A lot of us who were working, in fact, I worked in an electric company at that time, were very interested in what the effects were on children. And, in fact, the teachers were the first to suggest that the kids were demanding more quick transitions in the way they taught. So even Sesame Street, which I totally applaud in so many ways, had a negative effect. But the more important point I want to make is actually one that is directly connected to what Nick just said. If we look at how the brain reads Chinese first, it forms a circuit. And then let's take that same brain and say it's going to learn English. Well, what the brain does, it tries to learn English based on its Chinese reading circuit. It eventually does, but then it tries to impose on new learning what was already there. Well, by analogy, if our brains are becoming so, in fact, shaped and fashioned by a kind of digital form of approaching and accessing knowledge, it's going to influence and generalize to all other aspects of how we think. So our brain is very malleable, and Nick used James Old's work on plasticity in his article. And there are many wonderful new directions of research showing that that adult brain is terribly plastic, and that's a wonderful thing. But the other side is of plasticity is that it's going to exert an influence on other aspects of cognition. And I think that's what we're seeing, or worried that we are seeing, in how we think as a result of the Internet's influence. And the last thing I would say is that it's whether or not Nick or I are correct is really not the point. It's the concerns over something so universal and so assumed that this is the next best thing in our society, that if we don't raise these questions, it's going to be too late too fast. So I'm very much a research-based person. And after 7 years of research, my whole research base changed under my fingers. I saw that instead of writing about an apologia for the reading brain, I was, in essence, in a new transition. A new culture was really under my fingers with our children. And I had to stop and say, even without evidence, I must raise some of the same questions, and Nick referred to this too, that Socrates asked about a similar great cultural transition between oral and literate culture. And Socrates was right and wrong about many things, and Nick and I will be right and wrong about many things, but the questions must be raised, and I think the wise culture will take the time now to say, this is not a binary argument. This is an argument about what is the best approach to knowledge for the formation of our next generation.
Well, you talk about wanting to address it before it's too late, but isn't it already too late? I mean, the Internet is out there. You can't put the, you know, the cat back in the bag. We're already using this new tool. I mean, and as just, you know, to talk about my job here as a producer, I would never go back to the way it must have been before the Internet. It would have taken tons of phone calls to do what I can do in a minute now. So what about it being too late? How can we change the course we're on?
Well, let me say that there's two aspects to that. On the one hand, as I said earlier, it's not binary. There's no choice. My whole work, and I'm sure Nick's work, it's all completely based on our access to knowledge. But access to knowledge is not the same as approach to knowledge. And how you, Veronica, read that information is in part a product of also your set towards being a critical, analytical, inferential thinker. Now, what if your entire life had been fashion informed in terms of development only on that approach to knowledge, immediate access efficiency, and not given along the course of your development the real necessity to think below the surface, to analyze what that author said, to go into your own thoughts? this takes time, and it takes, Nick was saying in a different way, the poet Stafford called it, a quality of attention has been given you. There is a quality of attention that I think is being frittered away needlessly. I think we have to figure out, and technology, many of the experts in technology who are emailing me as a result of this of this book that I wrote are intrinsically interested in the same question. How can we as a species get to our best thought? And access is only half. You have access, Veronica, but what is your approach to what you access? We want a developmentally fashioned formation process for our young in which it won't be just the amount of integrated information, but how they probe that information, how they think about it. And that shapes the brain itself. Using those processes is as important as anything else. And what I think part of our concerns are is that we are short-circuiting the very processes, as Edward Tenner said, that actually created the Internet.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Now we've got Michael joining us from Algoma. Hello, Michael. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Good morning. I'm just pulling off the road. I'm calling from a car phone.
Ah, good move.
My experience is sort of similar. I'm a 64-year-old retired physician, so I'm used to reading things carefully and in depth. I have a background in comparative literature, so I've continued to read long, deep books and enjoyed it. I don't have a television in my house, but when I've been at somebody else's house and I have watched television, I find that when I sit down to read something that requires concentration afterwards, I find my eyes flickering back and forth, and I find myself rereading the same sentence three or four times and having a great deal of difficulty integrating it into the information that I have.
What do you think, Nicholas Carr?
I'm not surprised by that. I mean, it seems to happen very quickly for the caller, but, you know, I do think that our brains are pretty quick to adapt to a new way to get information, and when we go back to an old way, we, in a sense, have to do a little bit of relearning. And that's, you know, that's my concern, is this is more than going over to a friend's house and watching TV every once in a while. This is, you know, people from a very young age spending huge amounts of time on their computer, on the Internet, and changing, you know, with a great deal of influence over how they think. And as we do that, the time we have available to read deeply or think deeply becomes less and less, and our ability to do that, I think, erodes as well.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Diana joining us from Alma Center. Hello, Diana, you're up.
Hi there. I'm a public school teacher and have been teaching middle school for the last 8 years. And I guess my question was, considering that we've had a major change in federal legislation regarding instruction, specifically in reading and math, I was wondering if you're not maybe missing part of the picture in what might be impacting the literacy at the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I've noticed at the middle school is that I'm having students come through that what I call the culture of one right answer, that students are being instructed in a way at the lower grades to meet the testing requirements that doesn't require them to think critically or deeply, and that I see that as more indicative of a result of NCLB than of a digital world. So I was just wondering if they could comment on that a little bit.
Okay, thank you for that call, Diana.
And
Marianne, does that sound like something that would be happening because of No Child Left Behind to you?
Well, there's no question that there are good and bad aspects of No Child Left Behind. I think everyone will agree to that. And yet, if you look at actually some of the scores, here's what you see. Grade 4, you have children who are doing better in decoding in many ways, but and comprehension, but you see comprehension sliding down across the grades. Well, what is the nature of what happens in third and fourth grade is that you are giving the children the set towards real comprehension. if teachers mistakenly believe that all they have to do is get a good decoding proficiency score, they may well unintentionally short what is really the meat of what must happen in third and fourth grade, which is preparation for the real comprehending reader. So I both agree with the spirit of your caller and yet know that that was, of course, never the intention, but it's the detritus of what happens when we have good intentions poorly implemented.
Nick Carr, I want to touch on one aspect of your article that I thought was pretty interesting about the founders of Google. You talk about them. Their names escape me right now. But they talked about how their essential goal is to sort of align the human brain with the computer. And their ultimate goal, essentially, is artificial intelligence aligned right with the human brain. Can you tell us what you think is going on there and why it's dangerous?
Sure. Their names are Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and they invented the Google search engine back when they were in graduate school as computer scientists at Stanford. And, you know, it's been obviously an incredibly successful technology that all of us use often, you know, many, many times a day. But, you know, they've always, I think if you look through their writings and statements, they've always viewed Google as much as kind of a scientific endeavor as a business endeavor. And one thing that they say over and over again is that, you know, as mathematicians, as computer scientists, they view Google, the search engine, as a kind of artificial intelligence, or at least as a step toward artificial intelligence. And what they look forward to is a more complete and integration of the web and web searching with the brain. And they've even, you know, gone so far as to talk about, you know, the potential for, as they call them, brain appliances, where you'd no longer have to sit at a keyboard. You'd get the information you want from the internet in response to, I guess, the, you know, brain activity in your mind. So they're quite serious about this. And I think the danger is that it's not surprising. I mean, these are brilliant guys, brilliant mathematicians, and of course they'd want to, with a lot of money, and of course they'd want to be pioneers of artificial intelligence, because that's the big challenge, the big traditional challenge in computer science. But what I think it tells us is that there's an intellectual ethic, an ideology behind Google, and I think many other internet companies, that views intelligence is kind of a mechanical process and views information as sort of a utilitarian resource. And the ideal is to be able to harvest information as quickly and efficiently as possible. And that ideology leaves little room for slow thinking, deep thinking, concentration. And I think it explains why we're inundated to a degree with so much information so quickly on the net. And it's more than just, you know, their ideology and their intellectual ethic. It's also part of Google's and other internet companies' business models. They make money by feeding us pages of information and other types of information, and both, you know, attaching advertisements to that and collecting information about what we're interested in. So they have a vested interest. They have an intellectual interest and a business interest in keeping us distracted, keeping us moving as quickly as possible from page to page, from bit of information to bit of information. So this thought process that I'm describing, I think, is built into the very fabric of Google and the internet as a whole.
And you're bothered by this easy assumption, as you say, that this is what's best for, you know, the development of humans, to have this kind of fast, easy access, even faster and easier. And you're saying, I guess, that we just need to take a step back and not ask if we can, but if we should.
Right. And it's not, you know, my argument isn't that being able to scan stuff and to find information that used to be hard to find it quickly is bad. Certainly all of that is good, and that explains why we've become so dependent on it. The problem is if that's your entire conception of intelligence, and that's the conception that your technologies begin to impose on the users, we have to recognize that we're going to sacrifice something as well, sacrifice the ability to be contemplative, to concentrate, to be reflective. And for at least some of us, you know, those type of qualities are at least as important as the ability to gather lots of information quickly.
We're talking this hour with Nicholas Carr, who's the author of the recent article, Is Google Making Us Stupid?, which appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. Also, Marianne Wolfe, who's the director of the Center for Reading and Language at Tufts University. She's also the author of Proust and the Squid, the story and science of the reading brain. Hope you'll join us this hour as well and tell us what your take is. Do you think that the internet is eroding our ability to concentrate? Are we losing something as the speed of information picks up? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Garden Talk is coming your way after 11 o'clock today. After 11, Larry Mueller's guests include the new garden calendar. Or they rather introduce the new garden calendar from the Madison Area Master Gardeners. They are Dane County Extension Horticulture Educator Lisa Johnson and Judith Wright Rizel, the Assistant Superintendent at the UW West Madison Research Station. Garden Talk coming up after 11. Veronica Rickert back with you this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we ponder the question, is Google making us stupid? And of course, we're using the word stupid loosely here, talking about how we might not be able to concentrate like we used to when we're reading those big tomes, War and Peace, or lengthy articles, kind of like Nicholas Carr's article, which appeared in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. Marianne Wolfe is also with us this hour, the director of the Center for Reading and Language at Tufts University. And let's go back to the phones now and pick up a call from Barry calling from Spring Valley. Hello, Barry.
Good morning. How is everybody today?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. You know, as someone who has been in both the analog and digital world for a lot of years and working with kids in education in the digital side of things, I would like your guests to respond to the way I look at this through the eyes of a kid. And those of us that have lived in both the analog and digital world, we see this sort of erosion of thinking's ability, comprehension, reflection, etc. But I would like to suggest that what we are dealing with are kids that are born and raised into this digital world, and yet when they go to school, we are still teaching them in an analog environment. So you got digital kids that learn digitally, and yet we teach them in an analog environment or through the learning processes. And going back to your Chinese analogy, when we teach kids in the traditional fashion of our linear textbooks, then they go home and are in a digital world. They are competing in this same learning space. And what looking through the eyes of a kid, when I go to school, I ought to be using some of the tools that I'm using 5 or 6 hours a day outside of school, if I'm a middle schooler and beyond. And what we have to be able to do in school is to use these digital tools and the resources of places like Google to provide teachers to be a guide to teach kids how to do critical thinking, how to ask the right kinds of questions, you know, set up integrated units that kids learn to use their skills across numerous curricular or content areas simultaneously, because that's the way we live in the real world. We don't learn, you know, a subject of math for 45 minutes and another one, and we really have to look at bringing more meaning and relevance to what we're teaching kids. And this I hear time and time and time again from high school kids, that they're just bored to death because there's not much relevancy to what they're being taught. And I would like you to respond to, you know, whether or not you think that we ought to be guiding kids and really developing skills to accomplish what you're talking about within the digital framework, starting much younger in school.
Great questions. Thank you so much for your call, Barry. And Marianne Wolfe, what do you think about what Barry said? Do we need to be sort of revamping the foundations of the way that we approach education to make it inclusive of the digital world?
I think that we are in a digital world, and I think education needs to respond well to it. I think the questions we're raising in this interview are the sorts of things that we, as a group of people who are truly invested in the next generation, need to demand that we have better research on. There's no question our children have to be biliterate, if you will, or have multiple literacies that they know and can use. But how we do what and when are questions we don't know. I think our society is lurching yet again into a new culture without asking some of the questions Barry is rightly suggesting we ask. The best interviews I've ever had with people like at Tech Nation, we were after the same goals, but what works best for what kinds of thought processes? What is the best way to get an approach to knowledge that's a lifetime approach that can incorporate information gathering, multitasking, as well as the precious time that children need to know how to use to reflect, to ruminate, to gather insight? If we have only one modality that children are really using, which I think we're moving towards, and that's separate from Barry's question, I think we won't have room, and we will have bored kids. We have to really think very carefully right now how to incorporate what's best about the strengths of both of these cultures for our children, not to lose what is most precious about a mind that wants personal knowledge and knows how to probe and not believes, as so many children believe, that when they Google something, they know it all. Probably the most common thing that you hear after a child has an essay, I Googled it, I know it all. That's not the approach to knowledge that I think a society will best have.
Nikar, what do you think? Are we needing to revamp our education system here? Barry is suggesting that there is hope, that we can include this digital world and bring about a new sort of, you know, mental flowering, if you want to call it that, that people can improve the way that they think and get those same sort of deep thinking moments, but within those digital parameters.
Well, I think we are rapidly moving, actually, toward a digital mode of education, digital mode of knowledge, and away from what Barry called an analog mode. And I don't think that's being driven by teachers or educators. It's being driven by students who, as Barry said, are simply learning this approach to intelligence and to knowledge. And what I've been amazed by the number of messages I've received, you know, in the wake of the Atlantic article, and many of them come from teachers who most of them are quite disturbed by what's going on, which is that when they try to get students to do research by reading a book or reading an article, they're meeting with more and more resistance because people just assume that they're going to jump around, you know, use Google to jump around and get bits of information very quickly, grab some more off Wikipedia. So I think the digital model is rapidly crowding out traditional models of research and of education. I think Barry's probably right that you know, we need to make sure that we teach to the best we can, you know, good methods of research, good methods of thinking and analysis and critical thinking. But nevertheless, I'm less sanguine, I guess. I still think what this implies is that we are moving more and more as a society to a world of, you know, very rapid, very efficient, very immediate intake of information. And my fear is that it's by nature, we gain stuff certainly through this, but it is by nature a more superficial approach to information than deep reading or deep thinking or concentrated thinking is.
But who's to say that the time freed up, you know, from doing that won't give us time to do different things, to make new discoveries and invent new technology? You know, the quickness of it.
Well, I haven't seen much evidence that people are, you know, It seems to be more that we get locked into simply gathering information for information's sake. It's not so much, oh, I'll do this quickly and then I'll have lots of time to think. It's I'll do this quickly all day.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the phone calls now. We've got, caller from Brookstone, Minnesota. Hi, Heather.
Hi there. I agree with both of your guests. In 1992, I first got the Internet. I'm 58 years old. I have two parts to this story. 2 years ago, I moved out to the woods and swore that until I made my cabin into something livable, I wouldn't connect to the Internet, and I still haven't. I use WPR, BBC, CBC, and NPR, and I'm probably more well-informed than most people that use the Internet. I now read probably 20 or more books a month. I use a 1992 version of the World Book, and I go to the local library. I used to put my writing on the Internet, and I'd have people all over the world write to me, and that was for about 6 years, and it got to be really overwhelming. But one of the frustrating things, I'm going to skip that part. One of the other things is I was a foster parent for 15 years for teenage girls from 12 to 18 years old. They were so lazy. They didn't want to read. They'd say, I just want to look it up on the Internet. I wouldn't let them use my Internet. I'd say, you have to use it at school, because they didn't want to read. And at this point, I can absolutely say I feel more intelligent, more well-informed than I was when I was using the Internet. And the only irritating thing is I'm always hearing, well, just check on the Internet on our ad, you know, on our website. And I think, why can't you just give me some information? But I really feel like I'm not driven to distraction any longer. I do have time to contemplate things and reflect upon things. And I think we need a combination of the two things. And I really do think that kids need to be able to read and learn that way and to integrate the Internet with what they're doing. I don't even have cable TV where I am. And I really find that the news programs on the radio give me a lot more information than what I was actually getting, because I get so distracted by, oh, link to this, link to that, and there I'd go. And I'd forget what I was even looking up. So that's kind of my comment about it. And I love living without it, in spite of the fact everybody else has it.
You're getting lonely on that one there, Heather.
I know. And the funny thing is, even my son says, Mom, just Google it. I said, honey, I don't want to Google it. I don't have to. So,
well, thanks for that call, Heather.
Those are my comments for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Nicholas Carr sounds like Heather is saying she has more time without the Internet. And so in terms of the Internet being a time sink versus a time saver, what do you think?
I think she's on to something that, and this gets back to my, you know, your previous question, that certainly the net saves a whole lot of time. You know, I'm a writer. I do a lot of research. I can find stuff, you know, online much more quickly than if I had to go to a library and sort through it. But I don't find that I have more spare time for thinking on my hands. I just find that using the net and begins to crowd out, you know, everything else because it's so convenient. Oh, let me check the weather. Let me check my email. I got to, you know, let me check my email every 5 minutes. So I think, you know, I think Heather is making an observation that there's a lot of truth to it. Now, on the other hand, you know, as you said, she's becoming a very she's very unusual in her resistance to the net, and I think her experience tells us a couple of things. One is that as individuals, we have free will; we can make decisions about whether we'll use the net or not, or whether we'll, you know, check email twice a day instead of 45 times a day. But that doesn't change the overall, you know, arc of technology and the overall drift of society, which I think is to move more and more online and to view the Internet as really a universal medium that's with us more or less during every waking hour increasingly.
And Marianne Wolfe, we've only got about 30 seconds left, but what's your answer to Heather?
I would say I would applaud anyone whose life goes against sound bites and thought bites and chooses an approach to personal knowledge. And my hope is that one can have that across these various cultures. But I am very worried and concerned that the set towards immediacy and access to volumes of information is actually preventing us from thinking deeply and long and hard, and in the in-depth knowledge rather than information gathering. So I applaud Heather, and I hope the insights from her life may cross cultures now.
I have a feeling we'll all be heading home to read books this weekend after this discussion. Well, Nicholas Carr and Marianne Wolf, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nicholas Carr, the author of The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google. His recent article, Is Google Making Us Stupid?, appears in the July-August issue of The Atlantic. And Marianne Wolf, author of Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain. Thanks to Sarah Carroll and to Rhonda Fanning for their production and on-air production this hour. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.